Good evening, good day, and welcome to the Indian Interest Podcast, where we discuss geopolitics from the Indian perspective. And today, as you know, we have plenty of interesting things to discuss. We're going to discuss France, we're going to discuss Pakistan and other matters as well. But as always, before we get into it, let me see who all is there in the live chat right now. And let me greet you all. I can see Nikhil Singh Negi, Melvin, Lone Rider, Rahul Gandhi, Abhishek Singh, Pratham, Animesh, Forum, Manohar, Indian, Chidanand, Nikhil, Manmat, Lone Rider, Brijesh, Akshit, Ishan, Parlevar, Crazy Brain, Ajinkya, Vishal, K8991 Gaming, Tathagat, Suman, Shekhar, Sarangi, Typical Gamer, Joseph Stalin, Hello Tom, Unnati and Dugu Video, Zhong, Jina, Jitesh, Nandan, Asmenor, Akshay, Akash Kumar Singh, Harsh Zaveri, Veer. Okay, that's enough. Abhishek, Harsh Jain, Samarth, Acharya, Sushant, Gupta, Animesh, Abhijit Sarka fan, thank you, sir. Ritvik, Broken, Sahil, Ravi Raj, Arpita, Gaming India, Pankaj Kumar, Tyagi, TDC, Vaibhav Gupta, Hello Tom, Tips for All, Trupti Patil, Manohar, Changu Mangu, In the Achilles, Lone Rider, Xi Jinping, Dheeraj, UT Mish, Jai Gajjar, Vyom Chauhan, Somnath Abhishek, Jigar, Vyom, Krishna, Arun, Vedant, Nikhil, Sudarshan, Samar, Krabby Feet, ABC Crickinfo, and lots of other people. Thank you all for being on this live stream, and let us now get into the things that we're going to discuss. So yes, the main topic is going to be France. It's going to be the Rafale versus the FA-18 deal, that thing. But let us begin somewhere else. Let us begin with our best friends, Pakistan, shall we? Let's begin with Pakistan. So what's happening in Pakistan? Let's put something on the screen and see what events are happening there. Because it's going to set the context for what we'll discuss next. So here we are on the screen. So what's happening in Pakistan? This is from, what date is it? Tuesday. Today is what? Saturday. So 4 or 5 days ago. Pakistan protests rock Pakistan occupied Kashmir as Gilgit-Baltistan demands reunion with India. This is a place called Muzaffarabad in POK. And you can see there are massive protests happening there, furious at the discriminative policies of the Pakistan government that has exploited the region for decades. The people of Gilgit-Baltistan in POK are now demanding a reunion with India. And there's a whole bunch of things that's happening here. Yeah, so that's in the news. This is more about the same. Protests rock POK as Gilgit-Baltistan demands reunion with India. A huge rally in Gilgit-Baltistan can be seen demanding the reopening of the Kargil Road and reunion with their fellow Baltis in the Kargil region, Kargil district of the Union Territory of Ladakh in India. So the people in POK, the people in occupied Gilgit-Baltistan are sick and tired of the Pakistani occupation and the oppression that they've been suffering and the demographic changes that are being imposed upon the region and so and all that. Yes, there is no development. There's no progress. The standards of living are terrible. And right across the border, the line of control, the people in Ladakh, etc., are living much better lives. They have a far better future. So naturally, these people, they would like to, you know, have to see their territory reunified with the motherland, India. So that's happening in Pakistan-occupied Kashmir in Gilgit-Baltistan. In the meanwhile, we have the situation in Gwadar. This is from December 22, okay, in 2022. So it's a few weeks ago, like 3 weeks ago. Gwadar protest leader wants Chinese to leave Key Belt and Road port. Yeah, so the people in Balochistan want the Chinese to leave Gwadar. And there are protests happening there, significant protests. For over 50 days, the Hakdo Tariq, Gwadar rights movement, has been staging a sit-in protest outside the main entrance to the port. So that's something that was happening in December, in late December last year. Now, what else is happening? This is from January 2. Gwadar rights movement protesters threaten Chinese nationals, want them to leave the port area. So this is a continuation of the same protest. What was happening in December, for already 50 days old at that time, is still happening in January. This is from January 2 this year. Today is January, 14? Yeah. So this is from 12 days ago. This is from January 14. So this is from today. Gwadar security to be entrusted to police in wake of large-scale protests. So it's been in the hands of the army. Now they're transferring it to the police. That's what's being announced. We don't need to necessarily take all of these announcements at face value. So Gwadar security would be completely entrusted to police in the next 4 months in the wake of massive protests in the region. So clearly, people in Balochistan are deeply, deeply dissatisfied with what's happening there. The exploitation of the region, the colonization, the forcible occupation by Pakistan, and of course, there's a different occupation elsewhere, westwards. Yeah. So that's something that's happening in Gwadar. More Balochistan, this is from January 13. Balochistan stands up for its rights. Yes. To safeguard Chinese interests in Gwadar, the Pakistani government gives into demands placed by the local population. So a lot of turmoil happening in Gwadar. What else is happening? This is from yesterday. Gwadar police arrests Haqdo Tehreek leader over policeman's killing during the protests. So that's more political action happening over there. FIR and all that stuff. Yeah. So, these are the things that are happening in Pakistan. There are protests in Gilgit-Baltistan demanding a reunion of the territory with India. There are protests in Balochistan, in Gwadar, demanding the end of the Chinese exploitation of the region and obviously the Pakistani exploitation of the region. The Pakistanis are cracking down. They are trying various tactics. They are imprisoning the leader of the protest and much more. Yeah. What else is happening? This is again from today. Curfew and mobile networks. Curfew has been imposed in Gwadar. Mobile networks have been suspended in Gwadar. So essentially all basic rights, you can say, have been suspended for now. There's curfew and there's no mobile phone network available there. Obviously, there'll be no internet as well. So people are essentially disconnected from the outside world. Yeah. So yeah, that is the situation. They have imposed Section 144 of the Criminal Procedure Code. The Section 144 is even something that's there in the Indian criminal code or whatever it is. Yeah. So so that's what's happening in Gwadar. And in Pakistan. So lots of turmoil in Pakistan. And Pakistan is a nation that's essentially perpetually on the brink of collapse. Pakistan is, by most standards, a failed state. It's a de facto failed state. There are protests happening all the time. Nobody is happy. People are deeply dissatisfied. People are chafing under the boot of the Pakistani military. Yeah, all of this is happening in Pakistan. And the only reason Pakistan keeps on existing is because of support from outside. Now, let's see something else. This is related to Pakistan. So this is from January 11, that's 3 days ago. Dirty bomb fears as several kilos of uranium is found in cargo at Heathrow. Heathrow is the main airport in London. Package shipped from Pakistan to UK-based Iranians is at the center of Met Police anti-terror probe after being discovered when it triggered airport alarms. So let's see more about this. Nuke plot smashed. Deadly shipment of uranium shipped at Heathrow en route to Iranians based in UK, sparking terror probe. So let's understand where this came from. This is believed to have originated in Pakistan. It was shipped to Muscat, Oman. In Oman, it was placed in the cargo hold of a jet plane. It was then shipped to London, Heathrow Airport. And at Heathrow Airport, it triggered sensors. It triggered sensors that are essentially used to detect radiation. So it appears that there were several kilos of uranium in this shipment. Now, uranium is we don't know what... which isotope or isotopes of uranium were present in this. Yeah, there are essentially three naturally occurring isotopes of uranium, uranium-234, 235, and 238. 235 is the one that's used to build, to create nuclear weapons. We don't know which isotope was present in this shipment. If it is several kilos, I can bet my last rupee it was not 235, or maybe not enriched uranium. Yeah, but yeah, this is some. If it is several kilos of uranium, it can certainly be used to build a dirty bomb. A dirty bomb is a conventional explosive which is laced with uranium or any radioactive substance. So it essentially contaminates a large area with radioactive fallout. That's what a dirty bomb does. So this was shipped from Pakistan via Oman to the UK, London. And it was supposed to be delivered to Iranians. I mean, I don't know which Iranians, but it says Iranians. So Pakistan is indulging in these activities. Pakistan is essentially the epicenter of terror in all kinds of criminal activities in the world. It is a de facto failed state. There are protests happening within Pakistan. There are separatist, well-justifiable separatist movements in Pakistan-occupied Kashmir, in Pakistan-occupied Gilgit-Baltistan, in Balochistan, and God knows where else. Yes, a nation that is permanently in strife, whose people, our citizens want to no longer be part of the nation, and a nation that is essentially the epicenter of world global terrorism, right? This is the sort of nation we have at our doorstep. This artificial and temporary nation that was created by Western powers, essentially the UK initially, to further their the Western geopolitical interests. And this nation is still a failed state. And this is the situation we are dealing with. Now see this. This is something that was given as a Christmas gift to Pakistan last year. December 25, this article was published. U.S. willing to fund Afghan border security, says Bilawal Bhutto. Bilawal Bhutto Zardari, the foreign minister of Pakistan. I mean, does he have any diplomatic expertise or experience? No, he does not have any of that. But just because his mommy was the prime minister, that's why he is the foreign minister now. Anyhow, so he said he went to Washington, D.C., and he has declared, he has announced that the Americans are willing to provide Pakistan with funds to enhance border security for preventing cross-border terror attacks from Afghanistan. Cross-border attacks from Afghanistan. Well, the epicenter of terrorism is Pakistan, and the Americans want to fund Pakistan to safeguard them from Afghanistan. Right? That's the deal. So, funding has been provided in the 2023 budget to help Pakistan with border security. So understand this. Any money that goes into Pakistan will most likely be used for terrorism and for anti-India activities. The Pakistanis do not see Afghanistan as a major threat. It's certainly a threat for them because they have this massive border dispute between the Pashtuns, the Taliban, and the between Afghanistan and Pakistan. But Pakistan's number one sworn enemy, the one they are sworn to destroy, is India. And any infusion of cash or fund that goes into Pakistan will primarily be used against India. Any infusion of new weapons that goes into Pakistan is going to be primarily used against India. Everyone knows this. This is not some big secret. So when the Americans fund Pakistan, they are very well aware of what the funds will be used for. Yes? And yet we have this happening, that the Americans are willing to fund. I don't know how much money is being offered to Pakistan. Yeah? Maybe it's 200 million. Yeah, there's a number of 200 million over here. Now, this is about promoting gender equality in Pakistan. That's a whole different story. So the Americans want to promote gender equality in Pakistan, as if that makes any sense. In Pakistan, there can never ever be, as long as this temporary and artificial nation lasts, there's never going to be gender equality in that region, in that part of India which is temporarily artificially separated, right? So that $200 million, if they funnel it into Pakistan for gender equality, that again will be used for terrorism. So I have no idea how much money they are actually planning to give Pakistan under the guise of funding their border security or whatever, but it's all going to be used against India more or less, or for terrorist activities. The Americans know this and they are willingly doing this. Now look at this here. This is a different report from December 29. The Pakistan and the US join hands against the Pakistani Taliban. So that's the Pakistani flavor of Taliban. Yeah, whatever. Yeah. So even the Pakistani Taliban is anti-Pakistan. They have set up a parallel government, right, within Pakistan itself. Yeah. So the Americans are offering to help Pakistan to deal with this terror threat. And what did Hussein Haqqani said about in this? Tokir Hussein, former ambassador Tokir Hussein. He said that the public statement of support for Pakistan was obviously a part of the ongoing US efforts to rehabilitate the American image in Pakistan. So the Americans are now once again invested in Pakistan. Like I have said on this show itself a few weeks ago, and I've said subsequently multiple times, Pakistan is now once again a US vassal state. Yes, vassal. I use the French pronunciation, vassal. So, Pakistan is now no longer China's iron brother. It was for a decade or so. It was a Chinese vassal. Now it's once again back in the US camp, very firmly back in the US camp. And the Americans are ensuring that Pakistan is well provided for as a good vassal. I mean, there's a reciprocity over here. There's a give and take. Yeah. So the Americans are now very interested in rehabilitating their image in Pakistan. The American image in Pakistan has suffered a lot in the past decade or so, yes. And they are offering funds and all that. So there's this article in The Diplomat also. Now look here. Climate Resilient Pakistan Conference in Geneva calls for support amid post-flood challenges. And about nearly $11 billion have been pledged to Pakistan by various Western nations. Yeah, Pakistan on Monday secured over $10 billion in pledges from international financial institutions, donor agencies, and development partners, and blah, 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 all that. This was in Geneva. It was a conference co-hosted by the government of Pakistan and the UN in Geneva, Switzerland. What else do we say? Do we have to see over here? Antonio Gutierrez saying wonderful things. Very nice. Mariam Aurangzeb saying something. So let's try and see the breakdown of the funds that Pakistan is receiving. Mariam Aurangzeb is what? Federal Minister for Information and Broadcasting in Pakistan. Okay. The EU has pledged $93 million, which is kind of peanuts. Germany, $88 million. China, $100 million. The Chinese are still trying their luck in Pakistan. The IDB, $4.2 billion. I think it's the International Development Bank. World Bank, $2 billion. Japan, $77 million, which is kind of peanuts. The Asian Development Bank, $1.5 billion. US aid, $100 million. France, $345 million, which is not very much peanuts, yeah? Total of 8.57 billion in line with whatever. Let's go and look at this. It's IDB is Islamic Development Bank. Okay, that's 4.2 billion. World Bank is 2 billion. Asian Infrastructure Development Bank, 1 billion. Asian Development Bank, 1.5 billion. European Union, half a billion. US aid, France, 345 million. UK, peanuts. Germany, small peanuts. China, 100 million, and Saudi Arabia, 1 billion. Now, if you look deeper into this, apart from China, all the other nations and organizations and coalitions are more or less allied with the US. You could say they are, in a way, part of the network of US vassal states, apart from China. Saudi Arabia, thus far, is a US vassal. Obviously, they are now making moves which the Americans don't like. But thus far, the Saudis are very much with the US. And this may be, this $1 billion assistance to Pakistan could be a way of placating the US from the Saudi perspective. And there's all that. So the Pakistanis, who were until recently wondering where the next slice of money comes from, is now suddenly facing a windfall of over $10 billion. Yeah. And this is all a reward for Pakistan for becoming a US vassal once again. Yes. So that is where we are. So why has Pakistan become a US vassal? It's because the US wanted India as a counterbalancing factor against China. They were really worried about the rise of China until 2019. And that's why they really needed India on their side to counterbalance China. Now, After the pandemic, China's economy has crashed. China's manufacturing sector has crashed. China's Belt and Road interface in initiative is stagnant. It's dormant. It's more or less dead in the water. Everything the Chinese had hoped for has not happened. And the Chinese economy is crawling now. It's kind of going negative. So the Chinese are no longer projected to overtake the US in the next 20, 30 years. If they ever do it, it may be after the 2060s or 2070s, if they ever do it. So China is no longer perceived as a threat by the US. And therefore, they no longer need India that much against China. And that's why they would like to, once again, have Pakistan on their side for counterbalancing India, because India could become a big threat in the future, in the next 20 or 30 years. So that's the whole game that is being played. And that's why they are now wooing Pakistan, funding Pakistan, asking their supporters and their minions and their vassals to fund Pakistan. And the Pakistanis are enjoying this great windfall. Yes. So Pakistan is no longer isolated. Pakistan has all kinds of friends. Even the Japanese are donating 77 million, the Germans 88 million, the French are donating 345 million. That's not a small amount of money, 345 million, right? So that is the situation we are dealing with. So I just wanted to start with the question with what's happening in Pakistan, especially the aid that is pouring in, the donations that are pouring into Pakistan, so that it sets the context. For what we are going to discuss next. Now, what are we going to discuss next is the main thing. So we are going to discuss the Rafale versus the FA-18 business. So what's the news? What is the news that we have heard? Let us put that on the screen. Where are we? Okay. So here's the deal. This is what's coming in the news these days. This is from December 8. Okay, this is kind of old news. It's a month old. The Marine Rafale scores over the American Super Hornet in Navy deal dogfight. Okay, so what is this entire thing about? See, India has two aircraft carriers, right? We have the INS Vikramaditya, which is a Russian-built aircraft carrier. This aircraft carrier has a capacity of about 36 aircraft, out of which 10 are helicopters, rotary wing aircraft, the Kamov Ka-31 helicopters, and 26 of these aircraft are MiG-29Ks. Okay, so the INS Vikramaditya essentially has more or less its full complement of aircraft. Yeah, the other aircraft carrier is the indigenously built INS Vikrant. Now, this aircraft carrier can take about roughly, let's say, 30 aircraft. Yeah, there will be helicopters in there, but it essentially needs 26 fighter planes that can land and take off from an aircraft carrier, and that can fit within the space constraints and parameters of the INS Vikrant. Yeah. So essentially, by the end of last year, the two aircraft had been shortlisted. One was the American FA-18 Super Hornet, and the other is the French Rafale, the Marine Rafale, which is the Rafale that's designed to take off and land from aircraft carriers. Okay, so these are the two contenders that we had. Now, in December itself, these stories started coming out in the news, that the Marine Rafale scores over the American Super Hornet in the naval deal dogfight. So the maritime version of the French Rafale has emerged as the front runner over the American FA-18 Super Hornet for the mega multi-billion dollar contract to supply 26 jets for the Indian aircraft carrier INS Vikrant, right? This is from December 8. This is from December 9. The same kind of thing. The French Rafale M edges out the American FA-18 in the Navy fighter contest. So it seems it looked like in December that this was the deal. Now this is from January 4. First post after IAF, after the Indian Air Force. Now the Indian Navy to get French fighter jets. So this report says that the Indian Navy has rejected the American jet FA-18 Super Hornet and opted for the deal with Rafale. The deal for the Rafale M is being termed as a milestone in the relations between India and France. Yeah. So it looks like the Indian Navy is set to acquire the Rafale M. Now let's look here. This is from the Eurasian Times, January 14, which is today. India and France to sign a deal for the Rafale M fighters in March during President Macron's visit to New Delhi. That is the report that's being put out over here. This is a report in La Tribune. It's a French publication, 4th of Jan. And le Rafale Marine prêt d'embarquer sur le porte-avions INS Vikrant. L'Inde pourrait annoncer en mars la sélection du Rafale Marine de son aviation lors de la visite d'Emmanuel Macron à New Delhi, which means that they are also saying that most likely India is going to sign the agreement for acquiring the Rafale M fighter jets during the visit of President Macron in Delhi in March. Yeah, so that is what seems to be the deal. It looks like it's a fait accompli. It's like a done deal. That's what it looks like. Now, is this the right move? Yeah. So let's examine this from multiple perspectives. The first perspective is what I already spoke about. The Americans are aiding Pakistan. They are funding Pakistan. They are asking their vassals to fund Pakistan to the tune of more than, to almost the tune of $11 billion, almost $11 billion. They are offering Pakistan a $500 million F-16 upgrade package. The Americans are using certain terminology that is deeply offensive to India. They are calling the Pakistan occupied portion of Kashmir, temporarily Pakistani occupied Kashmir, as so-called Azad Kashmir, right? That's the kind of terminology the American ambassador used recently. Yeah, in their maps, we know how they show the region. Yeah, so the Americans are making very strong pro-Pakistani moves. Their actions and words both are pro-Pakistan, and you could construe them as anti-India. Any aid that goes to Pakistan is essentially something that's going to be used against India. So any move that's pro-Pakistan is going to be automatically an anti-India move, and that's what the Americans are doing, and they're ramping this up now, right? So is it wise for India to trust such a nation and acquire equipment, hardware, fighter planes from such a nation? I don't think it is. I don't think it's wise for India to buy weaponry from a nation that, too, very critical weaponry from a nation that is essentially engaged in hostile action against us. Yeah. So that's number one. That's number one. So that's one reason for being very wary of buying any critical defense equipment from the Americans. What's number two? Well, what is number two let me tell you a story. Let me tell you a story about the same plane that we're talking about, the FA-18 fighter plane. It's supposed to be a very good plane. Yeah, it's supposed to be an excellent fighter plane. Some people say it's terrible. Yep, people who have actually flown on it say it's not really great. But that's a whole different story. So the story is this, and I've spoken about this before, but let's revisit this, and I'll show you some actual documentation to back up the story. Yeah, which I may not have done in the past. The story is that in the 1980s, the Australians bought a bunch of FA-18 fighter planes from the Americans. So the Australians, as you know, are part of the, I don't think the Five Eyes network or coalition existed in the 1980s. I'm not sure when it started, but the Australia is part of the Five Eyes coalition, which is the coalition, the tight-knit coalition of the Anglo-Saxon nation states. It's obviously led by the US, and the four other nations are Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the UK. So these are the five English-speaking nations, which are the core group of the network of U.S. vassal states. So these are the four nations that the Americans trust the most. And the Americans sold the Australians a bunch of FA-18 fighter planes in the 1980s. Now, what happens? Let me show you exactly what happened. Yeah. So this is a book by Peter Hall and Robert Wiley. It's called, what is it called? Economics of War and Peace. This is available on Google Books. So if you go to page 59, it starts. Okay, the story starts somewhere here. So there is something called a passive radar warning receiver. Okay, it's one of the most essential elements of the electronic weaponry suite of the aircraft. Yeah. So what happened is this. Let's figure out what happened. The United States controls radar warning technology. So the Australians acquired about 75 of these aircraft, which were assembled in Australia between 1984 and 1990. And these aircraft had these RWR systems installed on them. Yeah. Now, what happened is this. The RWRs in the Australian fighter planes were configured for operations against Warsaw Pact forces, means the USSR and its satellite nations, all right? They were not programmed to detect radar emissions of US and other Western origin aircraft operating in Southeast Asia. Worse, Australia could not repeat earlier success it had with reconfiguring the threat libraries of its fleet of whatever tactical fire bomber aircraft. In the case of the FA-18, the threat library was embedded in the system's hardwired programmable system processor, and the US government denied Australian government requests for access to the algorithms that determined the operations of the processors and hence which radar frequencies it could see. So essentially, the radar of the Hornet could not identify most of the aircraft as in this region as hostile. In other words, the Australian front-end fighter plane could not shoot down people who might be Australia's enemies in the region. The Americans knew this and they denied access to the algorithms to Australia. Yeah, denying access to the algorithms that would permit local reprogramming and upgrade, all that diminished Australia's tactical advantage in regional air combat capability. So essentially, they sold very expensive fighter planes to Australia, and these fighter planes were essentially unusable. They were worthless. They were pointless. These planes refused to lock on to aircraft that could be potentially hostile to the Australians. They simply refused to lock on the radar systems. Yeah. So the Australians eventually claim they said that in the end we spied on them and we extracted the codes ourselves, and then we got another radar that could actually identify them, blah 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 blah. But the truth is that until 2006, the Australians were still struggling to make their fighter planes radars acquire lock on to the targets that they wanted them to lock on. So the fighter planes were acquired between 1984 and 1990. Until 2006, the Australians were still struggling to get these things to work. Yes? Here's the claim. This is from the Wayback Machine. This article has been deleted from the internet, but I was able to find it. So this is the claim that Australia cracked top secret US fighter jet codes. That's what they claim. There's another claim over here, blah, 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 all that. So essentially what we are seeing is that Australia is essentially a US corporation. Australia essentially is owned by the US. It's one of their closest allies. It's essentially a US possession. And yet the Americans denied the Australians these codes, the algorithms that would enable Australia to actually use the fighter planes. Yeah. So if they could do this, if the Americans could do this to one of their closest allies, do you think they would not do that to India? Yes. We already have this precedent that the Australians themselves have suffered in this manner at the hands of the US. The same fighter plane that we are talking about, the FA-18, yes? So isn't it likely that the Americans would do the same thing to us as well? So there is something called a backdoor. Or it's also called, well, in some cases, it's called a kill switch. You have a phone. Let's say you have an Apple iPhone, yes? In Apple iPhone, there is this theft protection thing, right? So if your phone gets stolen, then you can essentially disable it and it becomes completely unusable. That's called a kill switch. So inside the phone, there is the main component is the microprocessor, which is the brain, the CPU, yeah, of the phone. That's where all the processing happens. On top of it, you can install the OS, which is Apple's iOS or whatever. In Android phones, it's the Android operating system and all that. But everything, all the processing of that happens in the computer happens on the microchip, the CPU, the processor, which is at the heart of your phone. That's essentially a computer, right? And whoever manufactures this processor can install certain code, certain functionality in the CPU, in the brain of your phone, which will enable that phone to do things that you have no idea it is doing. It can remotely disable your phone. It can remotely spy upon you. It can remotely send your data or specific certain kinds of data somewhere else. Yeah, back home. If you have a Chinese-made phone, then it is highly possible and highly likely that it may be sending back certain kinds of data, metadata, location data, browsing data, God knows what, to the Chinese government. Yeah, and this will all be done without you ever knowing about it. So this is called a backdoor, okay? And which the nations that manufacture these microprocessors, these chips, it would be silly for them not to install backdoors in these chips, yeah? And such things have happened in the past. So for instance, in 2007, A Syrian nuclear research facility was destroyed by the Israelis. I'm sure I've got it somewhere here. Yeah. How Israel destroyed Syria's Al-Kibar nuclear reactor, 2007. So Israeli fighter jets destroyed this mysterious complex, blah, 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 all that. So what happened is that a bunch of Israeli fighter jets crossed over into Syrian territory, and the Syrian radar system simply failed to detect the Israeli fighter planes. Yeah. And what most likely happened is that these radars, the Syrian radars, they had commercial off-the-shelf microprocessors in them. Yeah. And these must have been fabricated with hidden backdoors in them. And so they could be remotely made to be disabled when the precise point when the Israeli fighter planes were closing in on Syrian airspace. So essentially, the radar simply did not detect the fighter planes, Israeli fighter planes. And that's why there was no response. There was no counter, action taken against the Israeli fighter planes. So that's one example of that. In 2014, the Israelis, as we know, have been supporting Azerbaijan for quite some time against Armenia. Yeah. The Israelis had sold various kinds of drones to the Azerbaijanis. In 2014, all of a sudden, for whatever reason, the Azerbaijani-Israeli drones, the Israeli-made Azerbaijani drones, failed to work, failed to operate, all in synchronicity in 2014. So once again, you have a hidden backdoor or a kill switch, which remotely disabled these drones. So at the heart of the computer in any military hardware is a microprocessor. It is the heart of the computer, and in the microprocessor you can embed various kinds of functionality that can enable you to control it remotely or kill it or disable it remotely. So the Americans already had the ability to do this in the 1980s. Yeah, the F-16s that the Americans sell to various nations also, I guarantee you, come with these backdoors and kill switches, which means that whenever the Pakistanis have used F-16s against India, it has been done with the consent of the Americans, which essentially means that the Americans did not see it appropriate to disable the F-16 when the Pakistanis were trying to use them against India. Yeah. So when you have a nation that has the capability to disable hardware remotely, especially critical hardware like a fighter plane, does it make any sense to acquire that weapon system from that nation? I don't think it makes any sense. Yeah. And so I think these are the reasons why it is a very wise move on India's part not to opt for the FA-18 fighter plane and instead opt for the Rafale. Now, listen, we understand the French also are not stupid. They also have the ability to do such things. But on balance, I would say that India and France have a much greater convergence of strategic interests and much in long-term strategic interests than do India and the US. That's why it makes a whole lot more sense to opt for the French weapons system. So let's look at the Indo. See, the French have a significant amount of interest in the Indo-Pacific region, and the reason for that is that the region. See, for France, the Indo-Pacific space is a geographic reality. France is present in the region via its overseas territory, and 93% of France's exclusive economic zone, EEZ, is located in the Indian and Pacific Oceans. The region is home to 1.5 million French people, as well as 8,000 French soldiers stationed in the region, which is why, and France is a major Indo-Pacific power. They may have nuclear submarines in the region. They also have an aircraft carrier, which typically doesn't operate in this region, but it's capable of doing that. And the French have, like it's mentioned here, a significant presence in the region, 1.5 million people, a huge exclusive economic zone. So they need to safeguard that. And to safeguard that, I'll show you why it is so. This is the Indian Ocean region. So for instance, there is this island of Réunion, which is a French island. It's very close to Mauritius. There is Port Mathurin over here. There are various other territories, French southern and Antarctic lands. That's also French, yes. And there are other possessions elsewhere, which we will not go and look into. So the French have a significant interest in this region. They see themselves as an Indo-Pacific maritime power. Yeah. And to safeguard their interest in this region, it makes a huge amount of sense. It makes eminent sense for the French to cooperate with India. And if India and France can join forces together, then it is a win-win situation for both nations. Yes. And that's why, and obviously we also have the situation that the US is quite hostile or rather quite antagonistic towards France in a variety of manners, in a variety of ways. France is obviously a part of NATO, it's a part of the EU, but it's the only nation in NATO and the EU which has a quasi-independent foreign policy. It has nuclear weapons of its own, not nuclear weapons that are controlled by the US. It has its own nuclear submarines, it has its own launch codes. And it still has kind of a colonial policy in Africa, which we will not speak about right now, because it is not convenient. Yeah, a little bit of hypocrisy is always in order. So recently the French had this deal with Australia to supply Australia with a bunch of submarines, advanced Scorpion submarines. It was a deal that was signed, everything was done, and then the Australians walked out of the deal because of the Americans. And now they're going for even more expensive American submarines. So it was a huge disaster for France. And the French are obviously deeply upset about this. Yeah, deeply upset with Australia and the US. So considering all of this, it makes a huge deal of sense for India to align itself with France, because our interests have a significant amount of convergence in the Indo-Pacific region. It is good for us from a variety of ways. So this is the French Indo-Pacific strategy, so to say. I think there's a document available here. Yes, you can see the document, and there's a 2022 France Indo-Pacific strategy, a PDF you can download if you wish. There's a summary also. So in India, the Indian Ocean is a major component of this. And here we have more. So India and France to join hands in fighter design and submarine design and manufacturing, yes? The 36th India-France dialogue will blah, 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 blah. So Monsieur Macron is coming to India to meet Monsieur Modi in March, I believe, yes? And France wants to become a key partner in the Make in India campaign, manufacturing aircraft engine and long-range submarine. Yes, the 36th India-France strategic dialogue will be held. Okay, this is already done. What else is happening? India is looking for 100% transfer of technology for making aircraft engines, which is something we really, really want, we really need. I think we should look to France for this instead of reinventing the wheel. Just buy the wheel and the technology. Give them whatever amount of money they want, as long as it's reasonable. Yeah. So we need fighter engines. That's what we really, really need. Once we have fighter engines of our own that we can manufacture in India with the full technology, then essentially we can make any kind of fighter plane. So that's something that India is looking forward to with France. military and civilian engines for future fighter and transport aircraft platforms. India Tata Group is manufacturing C-925 tactical aircraft and all that. The French Scorpion class submarine line is going to deliver its final submarine this year, which is when? Okay, this year, 2023, right? India is looking towards France to continue the manufacturing line at Mumbai dockyards with diesel attack submarines retrofitted with indigenous air independent propulsion system for long endurance. So we have a submarine manufacturing assembly line. You can call it an assembly line. It's in Mumbai. Yeah. The deal was for 6 Scorpion class submarines. The 6th one is going to be completed this year. And then the problem is that the assembly line will essentially have to close down, and all the expertise we acquired, all the people we trained for this, they will become idle, and they will essentially be acquired by other countries, and we will lose all this all these valuable assets. So India should ensure that this Scorpion submarine manufacturing line does not close down. We need more submarines, so we should continue this. So that's probably something that's in the offing, that Mumbai dockyards will continue to make more submarines, maybe 6 more. I would say make 30 more. Yeah, whatever it costs. It's really important for India to have lots of submarines. Submarines are the capital ship of the 21st century, just like the aircraft carrier was the capital ship of the first half of the 20th century. So we need submarines. And the French make good submarines. So that's something that India and France are working towards. And hopefully we will continue the Scorpion submarine manufacturing line. France is ready to help India in ocean bed mapping and underwater drones and sensors and all that stuff. So there's a whole lot that India and France can do together. Obviously, France also has to placate and mollify the US, which is why it is offering some aid to Pakistan on behalf of on the instruction of the US, essentially. Yeah, $335 million or whatever it was. So that's also there. But overall, we have to understand that the French have no option. They are part of the EU. They're part of the NATO. The US is a way more powerful nation, and you have to find some balance. So overall, I think there's a huge amount of potential in the India-France relationship. It is a relationship that is mutually beneficial from the geopolitical perspective, from the business perspective. The French have technology to offer to India. They have hardware to offer to India. We have cash to offer to them in exchange for that. So it's win-win. Yeah, and we have a lot of cooperation that we can do in the Indo-Pacific region. Yeah, so there's a whole lot of potential here. And the Rafale is one of the best fighter planes in the world. 4.5 generation fighter plane. Not quite 5th generation, but that's fine. It's an extremely capable fighter plane. It's the best one that we have thus far. Yeah, we have 36 of these. And it makes a huge amount of sense to buy the same aircraft, 26 more of those, so that we don't have to invest all over again in understanding the not the biomechanics, but the mechanics, the engineering of a whole new aircraft. Yeah, we already have people trained in servicing the Rafale and doing all that. So we will not need to train a whole set of new people in understanding a whole different aircraft. Yeah, and we will not have to go elsewhere for more spares. The more fighter planes you have, more species, so to say, of fighter planes you have, the more of a headache it is for acquiring spares for all that stuff. So it makes a lot of sense to acquire the Rafale instead of anything else. And obviously the FA-18 cannot be really trusted because of the reasons that I mentioned, right? So that is the situation vis-a-vis the French Rafale Marine, the Rafale M. I think it's going to be a great addition to our naval capabilities. And eventually, we will obviously have to go with the TEDBF, the twin engine deck-based fighter, which is something that could be available for us. It's an indigenous fighter plane that we are developing. It's a twin engine fighter plane, which is meant for aircraft carriers. So in the future, if we have aircraft carrier, more of them, we could use the TEDBF for that. So that aircraft, that fighter could be ready in about a decade or so. Hopefully, yeah, if things go well. So that's where we are. So right now, for the time being, we need fighter planes. We need to import fighter planes. So it's best to go with the Rafale and that's how I see it. I hope that the explanation I have given you also convinces you. that the Rafale is the right option, not the American fighter plane. Yeah. So that is about this matter, the matter of the Rafale versus the FA-18. Yeah. So hopefully that gets signed in March, and very quickly we can get those 26 fighter planes. And if we are able to possibly place a larger order, then maybe we could move the entire Rafale manufacturing line to India, which would be great for our Make in India initiative. The French are saying they would like to have an order of at least 100 fighter planes or so for them to move the entire manufacturing line to India. So maybe we could negotiate with them. We would need some transfer of technology also for that to happen. And let's see how that goes. So that is about the Rafale. Yes. Now let's talk about the situation in Ukraine. So what's happening in Ukraine? Let's find out. Okay, let's see. What do we have? Do we have any news of what's happening in Ukraine? Let's go. Okay, let's put that on the screen. What is happening? It's been a while since we talked about Ukraine. Things have been rather quiet in that region. So here's what's happening. This is a report from yesterday from Al Jazeera. Moscow claims control of Soledar, but Kiev says fighting continues. So Soledar is a salt mining town in eastern Ukraine. The capture of this town would enable Russian troops to envelop the nearby city of Bakhmut. And it looks like the Russians have already taken the city of Soledar. But Kiev is saying that fighting still continues and all that. Various reports have come out on Twitter with various videos that I would rather not show here. Yeah, all that. So, yeah, it looks like things are going really bad for Ukraine in this fight, Bakhmut and Soledar. And here's what one report is saying. There are no videos here, thankfully. The Russians have taken Soledar. This is from yesterday. The Russians have taken Soledar, breaking through the second defense line in Donbas with cascading effects. Horrific images of Ukrainian losses and frostbitten soldiers surrendering. Ground is now frozen. The Rasputitsa season is over. The ground is now frozen. Winter has come. The Russian winter offensive appears imminent. And there are reports of major movements happening in Belarus. Movements of Russian and Belarusian troops too. I spoke about this a few weeks ago. Things could happen now. So let's take a look at the map to see what the situation is. We know where India is. Let's go westwards. Let's go to the Black Sea region. Let's go to Ukraine. So where is Bakhmut? Where is Soledar? Let's find out. Let's take a look at this. Yes. So where are we? Let me orient myself a little bit. We want to look at... 1 second. Donetsk. All right. It's somewhere here. All right. Let's do the smart thing and just Bakhmut. Bakhmut. Just search for that. All right. Here we are. This is Bakhmut. So it's near Kramatorsk. It's near Luhansk. That's where Bakhmut is. And near Bakhmut, we have this salt mining town of Soledar, which is about 10 kilometers, 15, 20 kilometers maximum from Bakhmut. Yeah. And there's this huge amount of fighting that's been happening here for weeks, for months on end. Yes. And the media is calling this the Bakhmut meat grinder, which is a very horrific name. And you can imagine what's going on there. Horrific casualties. And initially, the Americans were saying that this is a vital, strategically vital region. And when things started going badly, the Western media is now saying that we don't understand why the Russians are going for this town, which doesn't really matter. Yeah. So this is obviously a strategically important place. And this could precipitate further action later on. So it looks like Soledar has fallen, and it looks like Bakhmut is essentially being enveloped by the Russians, and it could essentially fall in short order. So for the past few weeks, there has been, apart from the Bakhmut situation, there's not been much happening in the Ukraine conflict here. The Russians obviously withdrew from the city of which city was it? where was it? They're withdrawn from the city of Kharkiv, and they had also withdrawn from the city of Kherson, right? Yeah. And that was in preparation for the winter season. Now winter is very much here. The ground is frozen. And there is this entire situation going on in the Bakhmut, in the Soledar region. Looks like the Russians are about to prevail there. It looks like the Ukrainian armed forces are severely weakened. That's the kind of... it's the kind of reports we are hearing. Yeah, it's a terrible thing. War is terrible. There's a huge amount of suffering. There's a lot of death and destruction and dying. There's nothing to cheer about and glorify in this, but that's just how it goes, you know. War is something that sovereign nations have a right to do when they feel that their national interest is under threat, and that's how it goes. Yeah. So so now that Soledar seems to have fallen, and it looks like Bakhmut may also fall, that could mean that we are at the end phase of the war in eastern Ukraine, which means that it could move somewhere else. We also hear that the Americans are about to send Patriot missiles into Ukraine, which means that this could be another escalation of the conflict. We could have the Belarusian border becoming active, which means that you could have action along multiple fronts. Right now, it looks like we are in the calm before the storm kind of situation. The Rasputitsa season, the mud season of autumn, is definitely over. Yes. And in about a month or so, month or two maximum, you could have the beginning of the spring, which means the second Rasputitsa season. So we have approximately 1 month or 1.5 months, that sort of time window, in which there could be some kind of Russian winter offensive. Now, lots of people have started saying that a Russian winter offensive could be imminent. Initially, very few people were saying, I said this several months ago, that there could be an offensive in winter. Thus far, we have seen no signs of an offensive. It's all Bakhmut, it's all Soledar, it's all going on over there. But things could change in the next week or two. Let's see how it goes. When it happens fast. Yeah. So right now, the situation is thus, that we are still not seeing any major change in the shades of the map. Yeah, whatever the Russians control, they are holding on to it. Whatever Ukraine is controlling, they are holding on to it. There is massive, massive action happening in the Bakhmut region. The Americans are saying it's not important. Then why are so many Ukrainians being made to die there? Yeah. So yeah, that is the situation. Nothing more to report apart from this when it comes to Ukraine. But it is something that India needs to keep an eye on, because it's going to, whatever happens here is going to affect the whole world, especially from the economic perspective. You know, oil prices, gas prices could shoot up, and there could be a recession, there could be food shortage, all of this. So that's why India has to keep a very close eye on this. And obviously, this is going to have an effect on the entire geopolitical apple cart in the world. We are witnessing a whole geopolitical realignment in the world. It has all started with this conflict. So that is a brief update about Ukraine. Yes. Now, what else is happening in the world? We have other things also happening. So we spoke about Pakistan, we spoke about France, we spoke about Ukraine. Now let us talk about India and Japan. Yeah. So right now, India and Japan are let's put it on the screen. Where is it? So there's this Air Force exercise that's happening. It's called Veer Guardian 2023. It's the first India-Japan air exercise. Yeah. And this is an article from Japan from January 12. And the exercise is supposed to happen between January 12 and January 26. So it's the first time that the Indian Air Force and the Japanese Air Force are exercising together. And India is sending 4 Sukhoi 30 MKI fighter planes, 2 C-17 transport aircraft, and 1 Ilyushin 78 aircraft. And the Japanese have 4 F-2s, which is the Japanese version of the F-16. And they also have 4 F-15 fighter planes. So 8 Japanese fighter planes and 7 Indian aircraft, including 4 Sukhoi 30 fighter planes. Yeah. So it's a good thing. Japan and India, obviously, you may know that I am very fond of Japan. Yeah. And Japan, it's actually a natural ally for India. Unfortunately, Japan has been under US occupation since 1945, which means that Japan acts under a lot of constraints. Essentially, Japan's foreign policy is dictated by the US, and Japan's economic policy is also dictated entirely by the US. So, despite that, it's a very good thing that's happening. This is a different article that speaks about the same thing. Veer Guardian 2023. Indian Air Force troops with a Sukhoi 30 fighter plane before departing to go to Japan. That's a photograph from India. There are nice pictures available on Twitter about this. See, typically when these fighter planes are in India, Indian photographers are not allowed to come anywhere close to the Indian Air Force bases, which is why we never get any interesting photographs of fighter planes, Indian fighter planes. But thanks to the Japanese people, we have excellent images of Indian Air Force fighters and other fighter planes in Japan. There you go. There's another one. This is the C-17. Yes. Then you have some Indian fighter planes here as well. Veer Guardian 2023. This is a Japanese fighter plane flanked by two Indian Sukhois. So it's a good thing. I think it's a very nice thing that India and Japan are collaborating in this matter and training their Air Force officers together. Veer Guardian. That's another interesting image. Yeah. So that's something that's happening. It's an interesting event that's happening. India and Japan collaborating and trying to increase their interoperability of the two air forces. India and Japan obviously have been engaging in naval exercises together. That's definitely happened before. It's the first time that India and Japan are doing an air force exercise together. But the naval exercises have been happening for quite some time, including multilateral naval exercises in which Australia and the US are also involved. I think in December or something last year, recently India and Japan were involved in a four-pronged naval exercise. I forget what it was called, but it was there. So this is an interesting activity that is happening right now. Yeah. And obviously the focus is going to be on China. It is a nation that threatens both Japan and and India. So there's going to be the focus on that. So we are getting some nice images out of there. What else is happening in the world? Well, what else is this? So this is from January 11. All flights across the US have been grounded due to a glitch with the Federal Aviation Administration's computer system. All flights in the US were grounded. Yeah, that's incredible. That's a disaster. It looks like someone hacked the FAA's computer system. All that happened, it was the FAA system that alerts pilots and other flight personnel about hazards and other changes and blah, 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 was not processing updated information. Yeah, over 400 flights were delayed within, into or out of the US. And 1,200 flights were delayed. As of 6:45 ET, 93 flights had been cancelled. Yes, that's very big news. The entire computer system went down. The entire nation saw its flights grounded. That's huge, right? And what's interesting is that a computer outage hits the Canadian flight system hours after the US system went down. So not just the US, also Canada. The entirety of North America was hit. Yeah. Computer outage hits Canadian flight system, all that. So, so it looks like somebody, more than 7,000 flights delayed, another 1,000 canceled. That's a massive, massive attack. So this obviously isn't some kind of malfunction or glitch. This is clearly some kind of coordinated activity. And clearly, people will suspect one nation, which is China. So let's think about how many nations have the ability to bring down the entire flight system, the entire computer system of the US. Yeah, I think the Chinese most likely have the ability. I would say even the Russians are really good at hacking, and they also have the ability. Other nations that one can think of, which are less likely, include Israel. The Israelis are known to have extremely advanced cyber attack capabilities and so on. Yeah. So yeah, this is something that happened. And one wonders what it means, and one wonders who did this. It's clearly not an accident. Sometimes, yeah, you have computer malfunctions and computer outages and all that, but this is too big to be some random outage, especially when it hits two nations, one after the other, two major nations. So something is going on over here. Yeah, maybe somebody is messaging something, somebody is sending a message to the US, all that. What else is happening? US-Australia force posture agreement undermines sovereignty, must be terminated. So I have said in the past, I said today itself again, that Australia essentially is a US possession. Australia is a US corporation. Australia is owned by the US. Let's see what this piece of news is telling us about that. Yeah. So there's some, the US-Australia force posture agreement has opened the gate for the US to set up Australia as a launching pad for its next war against China. The Albanese, okay, that's a recommendation. So let's see what it is, yeah? The force posture agreement, Article 4, agreed facilities and areas. With full respect for Australian sovereignty and the laws of Australia, nice thing to say, US forces and U.S. contractors shall have unimpeded access to and use of agreed facilities and areas for activities undertaken in connection with this agreement. Yeah. Australia hereby grants to the U.S. operational control of agreed facilities and areas. Article 7. U.S. forces may pre-position and store defense equipment, supplies, and material at agreed facilities and area. The pre-positioned material, blah, 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 shall be for the exclusive use of the U.S. forces. The U.S. forces shall have exclusive control over the access and all that. U.S. contractors shall have unimpeded access to agreed facilities. As you can see, it essentially gives the U.S. within certain boundaries full access and unimpeded access and exclusive use various facilities and all that on Australian soil. Yeah. And it's essentially, this article essentially says that this agreement has opened the gate for the US to set up Australia as a launching pad for its next war against China. Now let's see further. This is again from January 11. This is from zerohedge.com. Top Marine General in Japan bluntly describes US as setting the theater for future war with China. Yeah. So Japan and Australia, they are part of two island chains, essentially. Japan is part of the first island chain that encircles China. Australia can be thought of as part of the third island chain that encircles China. So Japan has always been a place where the Americans have more than 100 permanent military bases. So it's a very major threat from the Chinese perspective. Yeah, from the Chinese perspective, it's a huge threat. It's essentially an outpost of the US, a major outpost. And again, Australia, it's now being used as a launching pad for a future invasion or war with China. So we have been talking about Taiwan, that the Americans may be getting ready to perhaps give up Taiwan, because we know that the Americans are relocating the core of TSMC, the Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation. They are relocating the core of that from Taiwan to the US. A major plant has already opened in Arizona, and another major plant is being constructed. So in a few years, Taiwan may become redundant. And yet Taiwan is vitally important for the US as part of its strategy to encircle China. It's part of the first island chain. It's a massively fortified island. And now it looks like the Americans have various plans of further strengthening their offensive capabilities against China and further bolstering the encirclement of China. Yeah. So this doesn't augur well for the future of Asia. Asia, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and Australia are being fortified militarily by a very far off nation. Yeah. Which means that a war could occur in the future in Asia. And that could destabilize Asia. It could, you know, end up causing a lot of damage and destruction in Asia. But on the other hand, it's good for India because China threatens India very strongly. So that is the very complicated situation we are in. Yeah, it kind of reminds me of the 1900s and 1910s. the decade and a half before the First World War, things were just as complicated in Europe. And it just took one spark to set everything in motion. I hope there is no war like that again. But things don't look good, you know. All these chess pieces are being put into position. And yeah, it looks like things could go bad. If they do, who knows what could happen. So that is the situation that we are seeing right now. Now, before we end, let's talk about China. Let's talk about India. So, we are now into the year 2023. Next year is going to be the year of the general elections in India, the 2024 elections. So this year, in 2024 is also the year of the US presidential elections. So there's going to be a major upsurge in uptick in political activity in the US and also in India. 2023 is going to be a very political year in both nations. Yeah, let's forget about the US. We'll discuss that at some other time. For India, it's going to be a crucial year. The ruling party, the BJP, Mr. Modi, Prime Minister Modi, and the government, the NDA government, would want this year to be great economically and from all other perspectives so that they have a great chance of winning the next elections. Yes. And obviously, we know that they have performed well and all that, but they need this year to go really well. The problem is that the Chinese are not happy that India has such a strong government in Delhi, yeah, at the center, which is very vigorously and robustly safeguarding and furthering India's national interest. Yeah, the Chinese are not happy about that. They would like to see a weak government at the center in Delhi. The Americans are also not happy that we have such a strong government in India, which is refusing to kowtow to their demands, to support them and withdraw all support from Russia. They want India to accede to the American sanctions against Russia. They want India to condemn Russia, blah, 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 all that stuff. And India has refused to do that. India is continuing to buy Russian oil, which the Americans don't want us to do, and so on. The Americans are deeply unhappy about India's strong, vigorous, and robust policy, foreign policy, and so are the Chinese. So from the perspective of America and China, they are in agreement with each other about India. They would both like to see a weak government in place in Delhi. Maybe some kind of coalition government, weak coalition government. Coalition governments are always weak because there are too many factions pulling at each other, which is why there's always some kind of common minimum program, which essentially achieves nothing. Yeah. So China and the US would like to see the current government lose the next election. And one of the easiest ways, yeah, to make a government lose an election is for that government to oversee a military defeat of some kind, which is perceived by the public, by the citizenry, as a national humiliation. See, we in India are very, we understand that we have lost a lot of territory in the past 70, 80, 100 or 100 years. Yes. In the past 1,000 years, we have lost Afghanistan, which used to be Gandhar. It was our territory. Then we have lost what is now Pakistan for now, temporarily. Yeah. We have lost what was East Pakistan, now Bangladesh. That used to be our territory. We have lost that. Sri Lanka. Lanka has always been India. Yeah. It's always been. So that also we have lost. We have lost Nepal. We have lost so much. And we have let go of Tibet. So whatever is left of India, which is the current Republic of India, the population of India is extremely attached to that and extremely sensitive about losing any more territory. Yeah. And therefore, from the Chinese perspective, if you were to put yourself in the boots of Xi Jinping, if he wants Mr. Modi to lose the next election, he would want to inflict some sort of military defeat, which would be perceived as a humiliation, in case he's able to bite out some more territory from India. Maybe some small portion of Arunachal Pradesh, or maybe cut off the Siliguri corridor or something like that. Yeah. And if that happens, the Americans will also be happy to see that, because that will ensure that a weak government comes to power and India doesn't rise the way it should rise. And these days, we are also seeing, of late, diplomatic negotiations, several rounds of diplomacy between America and China being conducted kind of away from the public eye. Yeah. So there could be some kind of agreement between the US and the Chinese vis-a-vis India. That, okay, Xi Jinping, if you go ahead and attack India, we'll kind of stay out of it. And we won't come in the way. That sort of thing. So this is going to be a crucial year for India. I'm not saying that China is in a position to defeat India militarily. I think if they try something against India, it's going to be an extremely foolish and foolhardy and stupid move. But who knows? See, if they feel really... things are not going well in China. And if things don't go well internally, then somebody like Xi Jinping may feel the pressure to create some kind of external diversion to placate the Chinese people. Yeah, because a leader in China cannot afford to be seen to fail. So if he's failing with the economy, if he's failing with the COVID crisis, then maybe he could try and show some kind of military victory that could assuage the patriotic and nationalistic sentiments of the Chinese public and stave away any kind of disaster for him and the Communist Party, especially for him personally. So 2023 is going to be a dangerous year. Yeah, it is a year in which India has to be extremely vigilant. I am not saying the Chinese are in a position to defeat India, but they may be tempted to indulge in some kind of stupid, ill-advised military misadventure against India. It is a possibility. And I am 100% certain that the Indian government and the Indian armed forces are very much aware of this. And I'm sure that we have all our bases covered. We have various escalatory steps that the Chinese will also be aware of. And there are certain things that they don't want to... There are certain weapon systems that they don't want to really see India activate. Yeah, and yet we have to be cognizant of the possibility that the Chinese may indulge in some kind of misadventure, because they have been doing this. There was Doklam in 2020. Yes, the Doklam crisis. Doklam was earlier. Then there was the Galwan incident, in which 80 or 100 Chinese died and 20 Indians died. Yeah, and then there was the December last year clash again, in which there were injuries on both sides. And all of these incidents have been provoked by the Chinese. Yeah. So this is going to be a very important year for India. From our perspective, this has to be where we really kickstart our economy again after the 2.5 years that the whole world lost. This year was good. Last year was good. 2022, India's economy did well. We need to continue that and keep going ahead. And other nations want to see us fail. America would be happy to see India not do well. The Chinese really want India to fail. So we have big adversaries. The Pakistanis, obviously, they want India to fail. Yeah. So we don't have too many friends. There are no friends in geopolitics, but there are nations with whom we can work together. So we need to find the nations with whom we have shared interests. Russia is one of them. Yeah. The French are another, and we have other nations as well with whom we could work together. But it's going to be an extremely important year, 2023. It's also a year that is fraught with danger. So yeah, that's where we are. So from our perspective, as the citizens of India, we have to do our best to contribute in whatever way we can to the nation and to its economy. And I am 100% confident and certain that the Indian government and the Indian armed forces are very well prepared and very aware of what the Chinese may be thinking. Yeah, you have to understand your enemy. You have to think like him or her. In this case, it's a him, Mr. Xi Jinping, is the enemy. Yeah, and one has to always anticipate what could be coming next. So I am sure now we have the leadership that is capable of doing this. In the past, it was not quite the case. I mean, a decade ago. But today, we are in very good hands. So that's where we are. So this is going to be a very important year. It's going to be a very crucial year for us. And if we do well in this year, then, yeah, we are well set for the 2020s. And we could cross the $5 trillion mark in about, I don't know, 3 to 4 years, maximum 5 years. And then it's onward and upwards. So that is where we are. It's a crucial year for us. It's a year that has a lot of opportunities. It's a year that will bring with it many potential dangers. That is where we are. But we will win together. All right, so that's where we conclude today's episode of The Indian Interest. Thank you very much for watching, as always, and I will see you in tomorrow's live stream, less than 24 hours from now. Until then, take care. Thank you very much. I'll see you soon. Bye.